Busted appliance? This is your sign to upgrade. Shop at Lowe's to get up to 35% off and next day delivery on hundreds of major appliances. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 3/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Order by 4 p.m. Available Monday through Saturday. Subject to availability. Fees, exclusions, and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/appliance delivery for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Today on The Grave Talks, Haunted Tuckahoe. Originally constructed in 1774, Tuckahoe was constructed as a single-room building. Over the next century, it would soon grow into one of the largest plantations in Virginia. It would see several owners in its continuing lifetime and hundreds of enslaved souls come and go from its property lines before it would eventually discontinue its activity as a working plantation. Into the 1900s, Tuckahoe would eventually fall into disrepair and then revived as not only a historical property, but continue to be a family home, a home inhabited not only by the living, but by the dead as well. Today, we learn its history with Holt Salzgiver on The Grave Talks.
All the way back to the beginning. Well, you know, I hear tell that the entire chain of the Blue Ridge Mountains was underwater for a long period of time. And it's a mountain chain that goes all the way from what is now America all the way through Ireland. That's way too far back. But,
yeah, not quite, you know, prehistoric
a long time ago, you know, before colonists even touched this earth with their feet, Richmond was a really interesting area. It was kind of the converging place of three separate Native American tribes. The two that had the strongest hold on the place was the Monacan Nation, who kind of really had control over most of what is now Virginia for a really long time, and as well as then from here east to the coast was the Powhatan, and from kind of this point south it was the Nottoway Nation. And so this area of land that that Tuckahoe is on in the Richmond area, partially due to geography because we're right here on the fall line, and partially due to many other factors, was the converging of these three different lifestyles of Native American peoples. And, you know, might have been the point of lots of battlegrounds, might have been a point of trade, but it was just a really interesting place even before colonists kind of came in and put their own spin on the history of this place as well. Now, the buildings that are here and that a lot of the hauntings that we know about centralize around the buildings. They were built around 1733 is when kind of construction started, and it continued for a little while. The main house probably, I would say, has the most activity that's been recorded, paranormal activity. It was built between 1733 and 1740. There were a couple of stages of construction, and it was built by the Randolphs, which is one of the first, you know, big wealthy families to get themselves really established in Virginia. The Randolphs were known as the Adam and Eve of Virginia because they had so many kids, and they just filled up Virginia with their offspring. And kind of because of how prolific they became, and because of all the wealth that they had a lot of influence over the place. So that's kind of part of why. Just because of their ability to maintain it the way that they did is part of the reason why Tuckahoe still stands, where a lot of other homes that were built around that same time period didn't.
Let's talk for a second about how the Randolphs came into the property? How did they end up getting the land initially?
It was the initial purchase of the land. It was kind of like a land grant that was given to them by the king, even though the king, of course, had no rights to the land. It was inhabited by the Native Americans. But that's how the Randolphs, you know, came to consider it theirs. And there was a series, there was a span of time where the Randolphs just kind of continued expanding their holdings here. There was a length of time when England was trying to get people to move to the Americas and to colonize. And part of the persuasion there was like, okay, you know, if you buy the fair, we'll give you this many acres. Well, if you couldn't buy your own fair, if somebody else bought your fair, well, maybe you're entering into some kind of indentured servitude agreement with them and you work for them for X amount of years to pay off that fare. But that person who purchased your fare also gets your acreage. And so we know the Randolphs did purchase the fares for many people who ended up coming to the Americas and increased their holdings, their land mass in that way as well. And it's at its biggest and strongest, the property consisted of about 25,000 acres is what I have heard quoted. So it was huge.
Yeah.
It was a big chunk of Virginia.
So what was life like there in 1733? Randolph's building, you know, their home on it, and homestead is saying it lightly, with that much acreage. I mean, what was their purpose? What was the land used for? What was it like there?
It was at that point in time, Richmond wasn't really a thing. Tuckahoe was one of the first major buildings, major places established in the Richmond area. I mean, Richmond was there, but it was kind of a dump. There was a lot of, you know, shacks. I mean, there are people, you know, living there, but there wasn't much established. No, Richmond was not the impressive city that it later became. Tuckahoe was kind of, it was just itself a city unto itself, and it was established as a plantation. So, you know, on all plantations that were established around that time period were sort of self-contained and self-sufficient to a degree. Mm-hmm. So everything that they needed was made or grown there. So there were lots of people. The Randolphs were not alone. Of course, they didn't do much of the manual labor themselves. There were many enslaved people, many indentured people that worked there as well. And this was pretty much the world for them, because they didn't go to the supermarket. They didn't go to buy nails. They didn't go to buy bricks. There was, you know, the bricks were fired on site. You know, there was a blacksmith shop. There was a dairy. There was ample garden space, everything. It was a town unto itself, and there was very little reason to leave if you didn't have business elsewhere.
It very much was its own ecosystem, if
you
will.
Yeah, absolutely.
When it was active like that, I mean, how many people are we talking that were there, that were from the combination of the Randolph family to those that were enslaved, to those mm-hmm. that were indentured? How many people are we talking that were making this ecosystem work?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we're just kind of finding out more about the numbers of enslaved and indentured people that lived and worked here, because a lot of that information had been lost. But we've kind of initiated an ongoing research project to kind of dig up those untold stories. And we're finding a lot of really great information on census records. It looks like just over 200 people was probably the max. I don't think it ever got to 250, just over 200 people probably total living and working on the property. And that's likely not including tradesmen that were hired out and just brought in seasonally. That's people who lived here and called Tuckahoe home.
So obviously a plantation and any place that you have enslaved people and indentured people, probably not, you know, always, you know, the most happy of you know, settings for everyone that's there.
No, not the sunniest way of life.
Yeah, exactly. What was life like at Tuckahoe? I mean, we hear different stories of different plantations, different, you know, settings like this throughout history, you know, some very vile, some not so much. What was life like there at Tuckahoe?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because, of course, history is written by the winners, but history is also written by the owners. And so we have a lot of information on the white people that lived here, but they didn't keep really good records of what was going on in the lives of the enslaved people that worked for them. Mm-hmm. So we have ways of guessing. You know, we have found runaway ads later on, and we don't see many runaway ads from earlier on, so it's possible that, you know, later owners treated their enslaved people more poorly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of runaway ads from the Allen time period, and it looks like a lot of people just kind of took off at that time period. There are fewer records from the Randolphs in general because it just didn't last the test of time, I suppose. But regardless of whether people were outright physically abused, I mean, there's a significant layer of mental abuse that is just the condition of enslavement. So even if someone from the outside could say, oh, well, they're being treated quite well, just because I don't beat them on a regular basis, that doesn't mean, I mean, the violence of slavery is the helplessness that goes in there. So, so that was significant and that was prevalent. What's unique about this place, I mean, of course, there were, you know, almost 200 people who were enslaved and living here, and most of the places that they lived and dwelled and called home were cheaply made and did not survive the test of time. But we do actually still have standing on the property original slave quarters, which is really unique because most housing that was built for enslaved people at that time period was, you know, cheaply made, quickly made, and so didn't last. But there are several structures here that were built in the same fashion as the main house and the other buildings around with a brick foundation. So they're still standing, which is really fascinating. And one of the most interesting parts about Tuckahoe, we've had historians come through and dub this place one of, if not the most historically intact plantation layouts in North America, because we have a large number of buildings, original buildings still standing on the original foundations, and three slave quarters are included in that. But as far as the way of life, I mean, we know that life was hard. I mean, it was hard for people who weren't enslaved. So, you know, basically working from sunup to sundown pretty much every day, likely got Sundays off. That was fairly standard. Anyone who didn't give their workers Sunday off was, I guess, considered not a good Christian. But there are a couple of kind of interesting things that have been discovered in, I guess we can't really call it archaeology because it wasn't dug up, but one of the cabins that was built for enslaved people had some fire damage. And they were doing some renovating to it. And in the process of kind of rebuilding, they found a rifle inside the walls mm-hmm. of one of the cabins. And that was really... there's a story there, you know, was it given to them? Were there, did the Randolphs, you know, have, people that they trusted with a gun, you know, an enslaved person that was trusted with a gun to not attack the Randolphs and were trusted to just use it for hunting? Or was it something that was kind of secreted away and hidden in the walls to be used at a later date and just forgotten about when the owner died? I don't know, but there are a lot of stories that we can just kind of speculate on, and that's the nature of what we've inherited here at Tuckahoe, because there are so few really concrete records of most people's way of life.
Sure. I mean, there's obviously, it's a lot of, you know, trying to put the pieces together without, you know, the documentation to really, you know, have it all there to say, here's exactly what happened. Walk me through more of the history. Walk me through more of the life of Tuckahoe as history progressed.
Yeah. So Tuckahoe, it was, like I said, it was established by the Randolphs. Thomas of Tuckahoe is the one who, I guess, first owned the property, and it was his grandson who finally started building, and he was also called Thomas. And the Randolphs owned it for many years. Let me see if I can get the my dates right. I'm gonna pull up my little timeline so I'm not telling you things that are lies. but it's been owned by five families since it was established in 1733. So after the Randolphs owned it, it was purchased by the White family, who owned it very briefly, probably 20, 30 years. And then it was sold to the Allen family, who owned it for the majority of the Civil War. And then after the Allens, it passed to the Coolidges, who were descended of the Randolphs, and they owned it until the Great Depression. They never actually lived here. And so when the Depression hit, I guess everyone was getting rid of financial burdens that weren't necessary. And then it kind of went up for auction by the banks at that point. And that's when the current family, in order to save it from being destroyed, they kind of purchased it. They bought it out from under a guy who wanted to dismantle it and put segments of it in the Met Museum. And so the descendants of the woman who saved it from being destroyed, Isabel Ball Baker was her name, it's still in their ownership right now. So taking it back to when the Randolphs first got the land, 1669, William Randolph moves to Virginia from England, and he's also called he's one of the Randolphs of Turkey Island. He moves to Turkey Island first. And in 1695, he gets that land grant for 10,000 acres from the king at what would be considered later Tuckahoe. Now, I don't know if you want me to throw a bunch of names and dates at you, but the interior of the house is really ornate, especially the part that was built early on. And that is likely because William Randolph, the next generation of William Randolph, it's really difficult talking about the Randolphs because they'll all name each other after each other. All the guys can be named William or Thomas. But William Randolph, the grandson of the one who originally purchased the land, he's the one who starts building, and he marries a woman named Maria Judith Page. And she is from a wealthy family a little ways away. And as a wedding gift, her family sends along their family carpenter with her to assist with the house that is being built for them. And he was there for the first iteration of construction there. And so the part of the house that was built when he was part of the works is just really gorgeous and elegant. And we don't have any information on him aside from that he was the family carpenter and he was a true artist. Yeah. The fact that we don't have any information about him suggests to me that he was likely an enslaved person. Mm-hmm. Because if he was a tradesman, it seems like, you know, they would have given credit to his company or his name so that it would help him later on. But we don't know anything about him except that he had carved the staircase at her childhood home, her parents' home at Rosewell Plantation. And it was a very well-known staircase. And to the point where people, you know, wrote about it, and it was pretty well-known, but it burned down. So really the staircase here at Tuckahoe is the last living, quote-unquote, representation of that nameless artist's handiwork. Yeah. And then later on in 1740, after that carpenter was no longer assisting, the rest of the house was built. So it's still, you know, very well built, but it's not as ornate and, and elegant. And it's not as much of a piece of art as the northern end.
Let me ask you, when we get to the point here of the Civil War and the Civil War, eventually, I mean, what was life like during the Civil War at the plantation? Let's go through that before we talk about what happens between Civil War and Great Depression.
Yeah. So it has to be, a really tumultuous time, of course. excuse me. There was a lot of, here we go. You hear the train in the background?
Yes.
we have a train track that runs right by the property. There was a canal that was built. It was intended to go pretty much the length of Virginia. It was supposed to go all the way down to Roanoke, the Kanawha Canal. Mm-hmm. And it was a project that was initiated by Washington, George Washington, but it never really got completed, because by the time it had reached this far to Richmond in 1814, the locomotive was starting to be more and more popular. So they kind of switched over to locomotive power and ended up putting train tracks in the footpath of that canal before it was ever completed. But the canal was a big part of Richmond transportation, and a lot of the people who lived and worked at Tuckahoe had a hand in the canal. There are records of the Randolphs leasing out the labor of their enslaved people to help dig the canal, which is an insanely labor-intensive job. And it was very poorly organized, because they had to keep digging the same sections out, you know, due to flooding. Everything that they would dig would just go back in. And it was an enormous amount of labor that ended up all being for naught, because 50 years later, it was the train tracks that was going down there anyway. So, you know, leading up to the Civil War, this is the kind of thing that that the people who are enslaved at Tucker are having to do, like, we're renting you out and you have to dig this canal, and you just have to, you know, dig it, and it's all going to be washed back in, and you've got to do backbreaking work digging it for the next year. And so us along with, you know, working the fields and producing whatever cash crop is most popular at that point in time, probably at that point it was likely not tobacco anymore. It was likely wheat at that point in the years leading up to the Civil War, but still very labor intensive. Tuckahoe was starting to be kind of parceled out and sold at that point in time. It was in the hands of Thomas Mann Randolph's widow, Gabriella Harvey, and there's a whole drama that kind of surrounds her and her interactions with the Randolphs and other very juicy dramas that kind of spurred from the things that she had done. But one of the things that she'd done that was significant to the property was she ended up started breaking up Tuckahoe and selling it off to the White family, selling portions off to the Allen family. She lived in one portion of it until she died, but that's when Tuckahoe started kind of breaking up and dwindling a little bit. Right in 1850, kind of right before the Civil War, we've got account books that let us know that there were 30 enslaved workers on the property at that point in time. That's when the Allens took purchased Tuckahoe. And just 9 years later, just a decade later, there were 60. So Joseph Allen, who purchased Tuckahoe in 1850, he doubled the number of enslaved people that were working there. So he was producing. He was trying to have it to build it back up to its, you know, former state of grandeur. And then, you know, two years later, the Civil War begins. And of course, as you know, Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. And so what must be going on in the minds of these enslaved people who are working here? I mean, I couldn't begin to fathom. But they're in 1864, 3 years after the Civil War starts, Dahlgren starts heading up his famous raid on Richmond, and the goal of which was to, you know, incite, you know, rebellion and get the people who are enslaved and who are imprisoned to rebel and escape. And he goes through and burns many plantations to the ground. His goal is to burn Richmond to the ground, and to kill the leaders of the Confederacy. And he comes to Tuckahoe. He stops at Tuckahoe and doesn't burn Tuckahoe to the ground, largely due to his social connection to Virginia Allen, who was there at the time. She was married to Richard Allen, who at that point owned Tuckahoe. And she and Dahlgren, their families had been friends, and they had been in the same social circles up north. And instead of burning Tuckahoe, legend has it, he stayed the night instead. So that's another way that Tuckahoe was spared from destruction. It's amazing that these, almost 300-year-old wooden buildings still stand, surviving many wars, surviving many natural disasters. And Virginia Allen's just chance connection to this guy, Dahlgren, who is trying to level Richmond, is just another kind of example of the luck that the structures around here had. So a year later, the Civil War ends, and the Emancipation Proclamation announces that all of the enslaved people at Tuckahoe are freed. Now, how long it takes for the people who are enslaved at Tuckahoe to find out that they're free, who knows? I mean, I would understand it if they didn't find out for another year. I mean, I guess their owners would have reason to try and hide that information from sure. them, but of course they would have found out sooner or later. But some did stay on and live here as paid servants after that. Mm-hmm. So we can draw whatever conclusions we would like from that. There were significant changes that happened all over the property at that point. Structures the use of certain structures were kind of reorganized to make work more efficient, because all of a sudden, I have to pay these people. Let me try and make their work more efficient rather than having them do, absolutely pointless repetition or, mm-hmm. lugging things from so far away. You have to think about things differently. All of a sudden, when you have to think of them as, these are people that I'm paying rather than just unpaid labor. So, But that's kind of the story of the Civil War here. And then, shortly after that, 1876-ish to the 1900s, it's, the rise of industrial America. So people are kind of funneling out of these rural areas, mm-hmm. that Tuckahoe is still a rural area, and everybody's moving to the cities, and very quickly life changes dramatically. You go from kerosene lamps, or you just go from candles to electric light bulbs in one lifetime. You go from walking everywhere or riding a horse to hopping on a train or getting an electric trolley. It's life changed really dramatically in a 30-year span. And so those changes happened here at Tuckahoe as well. We don't have, again, this is the same song that I'm singing, we don't have a lot of details, mm-hmm. About how these changes affected Tuckahoe. But they definitely did. A lot of this time, Tuckahoe was uninhabited. I don't want to say a whole lot, but during after the Civil War, and I'm not sure at what point it became uninhabited. I know the Coolidges came in and purchased it from the Allens in, mm-hmm. like 1898. But I'm not entirely sure if the Allens lived here after, that entire time period. But yeah. I know the Coolidges never owned it. So it was, from end of the 1800s up until it was purchased in 1933, or 35, excuse me. It was just kind of, it was vacant. And a lot of the buildings had fallen into disrepair. The schoolhouse on the property, which is the schoolhouse that Thomas Jefferson learned to read and write in, had fallen into disrepair. And the Coolidges, they did oversee renovation of that site, mm-hmm. as well as the cemetery wall and things like that. But other things just kind of went by the wayside.
So at that point, people start to recognize and understand historical significance of buildings and things like that.
Yeah,
in our country. It's not just, you know, the buildings having a purpose for commerce or for business or anything like that, or for living. It's now these are historic by the turn of the century.
And they're worth preserving.
And they're realizing these are worth preserving and understanding their history. So after the Great Depression, am I correct in saying that the property is no longer really looked at as this is going to be someone's home? This is a historic site. And people are saying, let's try and preserve this and figure out what to do so future generations can see and understand its history.
Yeah, well, yes and no. Because Isabel Ball Baker comes in and she purchases it in, you know, 1935. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, the way of preserving history was just to buy it, to keep it from being leveled. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and so that was her way of preserving it, but it was still a home for her. She lived there, and her children lived there. And believe it or not, it is still lived in. It is an odd combination of museum and home right now. It's strange to think about. So the current owners are the descendants of actually his grandmother is Isabel Ball Baker, but he. Mr. Thompson still owns and manages the property, and it has been his life's work to sort of get it recognized as a historic national landmark, which he succeeded in doing in 1969. And then and the outbuildings as well too. And then it was finally opened. It was placed under historic conservation easement. In the 80s, and finally it was opened up for tours and at the end of the 70s, so 79, I believe it was, the grounds and buildings at Tuckahoe are opened up for the first time for historic tours. It was a home then, and it is a home now, but we still have tourists come through all of the time. We have standing open hours, and so it is both.
I had no idea that it was still actually lived in. Let me ask you this. When we understand a lot of the history of the property, we understand a lot of, kind of where, you know, in a nutshell, you know, where it started and where it's at today. When you look back at the history of this and obviously it's well known and it's talked about openly of the hauntings at Tuckahoe. What is the furthest back report that you're aware of, whether it's just rumors, whether it's just someone kind of sharing this with somebody? What's the first known report that, you know, there may be something else going on here other than just the current residents inhabiting the property?
So the Gray Lady is our longest residing ghost here. There've been reports about sightings of the Gray Lady from as far back as the 1800s, I think mid 1800s, and there have been sightings of her periodically through over the years since then. Who she is, we don't really know. There are a couple of theories, of course. Some people think it might be Mary Randolph, one of the Mary Randolphs. Some people might think it is Judith Randolph, the daughter of Thomas Mann. She's she married her first cousin, and then her younger sister Nancy, and the man that she married had an affair, which is also in a pregnancy, and the baby was murdered, and it was this, and she was, you know, kind of enraged and driven by anger, she went crazy, as the story says, and she allegedly poisoned her husband, Richard, and he died. And then, you know, Judith's own son was born a deaf mute and died very young. And so some people think it might be her, which, you know, I could see the connection. But we don't, of course, know, because people don't speak to the ghost. She's never spoken to anybody. And she has appeared only to ladies. Mm-hmm. And but also people have described her as wearing a dress that looks bridal. So she, you know, might have been someone who was left at the altar, or someone who was married there and, you know, their husband, you know, died young. It's really hard to say, but the most recent sightings of her have actually been in the past 3 years, one of our docents saw her during a Christmas tour, no less. It was not a Christmassy thing to experience during that time period. But and it was, I am a self-proclaimed skeptic and tend to be rather skeptical of things, as she is as well. But she was far more skeptical than anybody out there. She didn't believe in any ghosts, any of the ghost stories. She was very humbug about it. And then to have her, you know, the ghost white kind of shaken, telling mm-hmm. you, I need to take a break. I just saw a ghost. You take it a little bit more seriously. So that was probably the most recent sighting of our oldest ghost, but there's a lot of stories. I mean, we just had, last month, 2 months ago, we've had many paranormal investigations happen on the property over the years. But we had our first one in July that was open to the public, where, people were encouraged to come in and join the paranormal investigators and just be kind of part of that process. And we let them into several of the buildings on site, and they, you know, they keep their evidence board. And there was all kinds of evidence that people were reporting. Oh, I heard this, and I picked this on these readings up, and things like that. But there was more activity than I thought. I, you know, from the stories that we hear and the things that folks who have lived here have experienced, most of it tends to center around the main house. But, you know, this crew of, I think this is 50 or 60 people came through, and there was evidence of activity all over the grounds, even in the storehouse, in the smokehouse, in the old kitchen. They were picking up on something. They were getting lots of readings. And so that was kind of a cool thing to hear about their experiences there. My own experiences here have been limited. I did live on the property for a number of years, and actually in one of the cabins. Most of the cabins are lived in by employees, and I don't proclaim to be particularly sensitive to this kind of thing, but my dogs apparently are, and they would tell me when something was going on that I wasn't picking up on. So
that wraps up the first part of our conversation with Holt Sulzgiver about haunted Tuckahoe. In part two, how has the Gray Lady appeared to people at Tuckahoe, who initially started accepting and talking about the hauntings at Tuckahoe? How much of the hauntings at Tuckahoe are believed to be residual versus conscious? And what happened during a movie shoot in the 1990s that seemed to have driven a spirit from the property? Those questions and more as we continue our conversation. To hear them, become a gravekeeper, that's a supporter of our program, sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks or go to our website, thegravetalks.com, and click become a gravekeeper. $5 a month gets you access to all of our bonus episodes in their entirety, and you also keep us on the air. You get access to hundreds of interviews and all of the episodes not released to the public yet, advanced episodes, all of it commercial free. We greatly appreciate your support. Patreon.com/thegravetalks to access all of that. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Are you a fraud-paying American? It's a fact that one in four honest, hardworking, tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. With LifeLock Identity Theft Protection, though, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, and get you your money back. Last year, the IRS flagged over $16 billion in refunds for identity fraud. That's billions of dollars that could come from your salary, overtime, or second job. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. And if your information does fall into the wrong hands, only LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists who are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.